Early one morning, April 2010, Tom Bishop and a group of federal investigators gathered together at a New York City hotel. They were about to bust a couple of international criminals.
So we went in, and obviously we have our gear on, and we're identified as federal agents, police. And it is quite intimidating at 5 o'clock in the morning when we go to the hotel and eight armed federal agents are there. And the manager, the night manager at the hotel, at this point, there's very little activity because people are sleeping. And we say, we're looking for these folks.
They were looking for Mauricio Cohen Azor and Leon Cohen Levy, a father-son team of Miami Beach hotel developers suspected of defrauding the United States of America.
They lived in Monaco. They had different citizenships. They invested in properties all over the world. They set up Panamanian companies to receive the proceeds of these, various deals and things like that. They were your typical tax evaders using the foreign offshore bank accounts as a way to conceal their income and their wealth.
Now, by now, you can probably guess that when federal agents raided that hotel, Tom Bishop's jacket had the big, bold letters IRS emblazoned on the back. Bishop is currently an investigator for a private sector accounting firm.
Prior to that, I spent 26 years just about at the IRS criminal division, where I retired as the director of international field operations.
And over that time, he investigated a wide range of federal tax fraud, including cases like the Cohens, who owned a global investment portfolio worth more than $100 million, hidden in a Russian doll of shell companies. The assets included a $10 million condo at Trump Tower in New York, hotel properties in Miami Beach, a Rolls Royce, a Bentley, a Ferrari, and a $1.2 million helicopter. None of it had been reported to the IRS. Tom Bishop told us more about the investigation that led to the Cohen's arrest on April 15th, 2010. Yep, tax day.
We had gotten information about the Cohens that they had sold a hotel in New York somewhere north of $30 million in proceeds. They never reported it. The money just sort of disappeared. And we had gotten information that it was secreted away in a bank account offshore. In this instance, we were working with U.S. Department of Justice Tax Division prosecutors, and there were a handful of them that decided that we should stop doing the normal, get all the records in, analyze them to death, and then, see if we've got a case. And the term they use is, we're going to start doing these cases like gun and drug cases were done, really quick. Used all the tools in our toolbox to go after these guys. For instance, they were put on watch lists. And, so for instance, when we had information to suggest that the Cohens were coming into New York, and we were able to put lookouts at the border. So when they flew into JFK Airport, we were able to pick up their movements, have them interviewed by customs as to what they were doing, what their agenda was. So at this point, we could find out where they were staying, where they were going, what they were claiming to have, their reason to be in New York, for instance. But those types of things we never did in typical tax cases. We were able to get the files related to the Cohens, which included things such as when you call up your bank or somewhere as a regular person and they say, this call may be monitored for quality purposes, that type of a spiel. I don't think that the Cohens believed perhaps that was actually occurring. Things that they talked about on the calls were such as, not having, the IRS know about this stuff. So things like that tipped us off, and we started looking, and we found boats and properties and vehicles and all these different things that were either titled in other company names and things of that nature that had no real connection to the Cohens. And once we were able to find that they were using various offshore corporations, shell companies, we were able to connect the dots. We had this great sort of folder of information. And then we got the tip that they were in New York and we were able to find them. Imagine, in a city of, 10 million people or so, finding two guys in a hotel in New York City at 5:30 in the morning. And we executed an arrest warrant in a hotel in New York City at about 6 a.m. Interestingly enough, we had gone in, we had to show the pictures of the two men as opposed to names to find them. And the hotel pointed us right to the two rooms where the son was staying, as well as his parents were in a different room. We were able to go up there and arrest them crack of dawn. And that was the last time they were out before they were arrested and then where they went to trial. When we brought them to their initial hearing in the Southern District of New York, and pretrial services, once you're arrested and processed, will take down a lot of your financial information and it lists bank accounts and assets. And of course, as we expected, they listed nothing, you know, very, very, very little claimed in assets. And what was interesting to me was the son claimed that he had approximately $250 in a checking account in Monaco, I believe it was. And that was the extent of his assets. But when we arrested him, on his nightstand was his pocket money, which consisted of, you know, quite a bit of money, way more than he had in his bank account. So when he went in before the judge and said, this is all I had, you know, I whispered to the prosecutor and I said, by the way, we have in an envelope we want to give to his attorney because we didn't want to leave it in the hotel room. You know, hundreds and hundreds of dollars and $100 bills that were on the nightstand. So it was funny, he was walking around with more money than he claimed to have in his entire world. And they went to trial and they lost and they were convicted and were sentenced to 10 years. What came to light several years ago was that Mr. Cohen had penned a letter and then there was a news series or something on it where he had written this letter and claimed that, you know, he was kidnapped by the IRS. You know, I guess that was his perspective when we arrested him and he was in U.S. custody and then took several weeks to get down to Florida. But not very happy about it. And it was just an interesting way. And everything seemed to work out perfectly for us in being able to find these things because it's not usually that way. The folks are out there doing this stuff, the folks that do this sort of tax evasion, and they deprive the Treasury of all these funds. What it does is it forces the, you know, the average person to have to pay more. You know, some of these rich folks or some of the more greedy folks that have the ability to conceal their income and wealth, well, then that just deprives the government of necessary funding for roads and schools and military and quality of life issues and programs that the government provides. And so it affects everybody. It affects everybody in the country.
Tom Bishop is former director of international field operations at the IRS Criminal Division. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And these days, the Biden administration has put a great deal of focus on closing legal tax loopholes and increasing taxes on the highest earners in the country.
It's time for corporate America and the wealthiest 1% of Americans to just begin to pay their fair share.
But what if there's another way to raise vast amounts of revenue without raising taxes at all? Well, we're joined now by Charles Rosati. He is a former commissioner at the IRS. Charles Rosati, welcome.
Thank you, Agnes.
Fred Goldberg also joins us. He's as well a former IRS commissioner. Welcome to you, Fred.
Thanks, Magna.
So, Charles Rosati, let me start with you. How much money could the federal government recover if everybody actually paid the taxes they legally owe?
It's a lot. In 2019, it was about $580 billion. And for the next 10 years, it would be $7 trillion. Those are numbers that most people can't cope with. So let me put it this way. That's as much as 135 million individual taxpayers pay altogether. Now, that's the whole thing. You're not going to collect it all. But that's how big the tax gap is.
Okay, so let me try to wrap my head around this. So in 2019, the amount that was owed to the Treasury but not paid, $580 billion. As far as I understand, that's more than what, 90% of taxpayers pay?
Correct. All the income taxes, the lowest earning 90%.
Okay, and then in 10 years, that tax gap could total $7 trillion?
And that is also correct, because it keeps growing every year.
Fred Goldberg, how did it get that big?
Magna, where do we begin? But the short answer is that where income is reported to the taxpayer and to the IRS, folks pay well more than 90% of what they owe. What have I just described? Working men and women. Folks get a salary. They earn some interest. They pay what they owe. The reason for the tax gap in very large measure is that certain types of income fly below the radar screen. If it's below the radar screen, there are a fair number of folks who don't report it. There are a lot of folks who still do, but that's where the gap is.
Okay. And no, go ahead, please. I didn't mean to stop you.
You know, and that's why getting more income visible is important. And it's also why the IRS, we'll get into the solutions, but folks need to pursue it.
Yeah.
Folks need to think the IRS is going to chase it if it's out there.
Well, and it clearly is out there. I mean, the amount of money that the two of you are describing is mind-boggling. We recently saw, as you well know, an op-ed that appeared in the New York Times written by former secretaries of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner, Jacob Lew, Hank Paulson, Robert Rubin, Larry Summers. And they describe the tax gap. The tax gap also seems like a very genteel way of saying the amount that people are cheating on their taxes, but it's the equivalent of 2/3 of total non-defense discretionary spending by the federal government, more than the mandatory federal expenditures on Medicaid. So the amount that's being left there on the table, so to speak, Fred Goldberg, could be transformative to what the federal government could do for the American people.
Yes, ma'am. And that's why it's so prominent today. Because there's bipartisan desire to invest in infrastructure. The first place to start is get folks who owe what they owe to pay what they owe. That's the place to start.
So we're going to come back from a quick break and talk with you, Fred, and you, Charles, about a plan that you have on how to close the tax gap. But I also want to come up with a better name for it, how to go after the tax cheats in the United States. So we'll explore that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the vast amounts of money that are legally owed to the federal treasury, taxes that are legally owed and not paid. It's called the tax gap, and it is growing rapidly every year. So we're joined today by two former commissioners of the IRS, and we're going to hear in a few minutes their plan on how to close that tax gap. And again, this is money that's legally owed. These are tax evaders we're talking about. And it's a really important part of any overall plan to increase federal revenues, in addition to what the Biden administration is focused on, which is raising taxes. But here we're talking about going after taxes already owed. Now, for example, during a Senate Finance Committee hearing in April, the current IRS commissioner, Charles Rettig, had this take on how big that tax gap could be.
I think it would not be outlandish to believe that the actual tax gap could approach and possibly exceed $1 trillion per year.
I'm joined today by Charles Rosati, former IRS commissioner under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. Fred Goldberg is also with us. He served as IRS commissioner under President George H.W. Bush. Now, before we get to your three-pronged solution here, gentlemen, I still want to explore sort of what the current dynamics of this tax gap are. And first of all, Charles Rosati, let me start with you. I understand that basically, the gap has doubled in the past 10 years, and it could double again in another 10 years, reaching that cumulative $7 trillion number that you gave us earlier. So why is the rate of the growth of the gap increasing so rapidly?
Okay, so it grows for two reasons. One is very simple. The economy grows, so if you have the same percentage, it's a bigger number. But the other reason is that as Fred Goldberg said to you earlier, that the kinds of income that are much more likely to not be reported are also growing. Think about the gig economy, but also just think about business. Basically, what it boils down to is that wage earners and people that just get simple interest and dividends get all their income reported. But most business income is not reported by a third party. So it's all only up to the taxpayer to report it. And that's really what causes the difference. So if that source of income that is less likely to be reported is growing faster, which it is, not only from individuals, but through businesses such as partnerships, then the tax gap grows.
I understand that regarding income that's coming via pass-through corporations that and partnerships, as you mentioned, that is up nearly 80% over a certain period of time in the United States?
Yes, it's up. If you go back even longer, let's say to the mid-80s, the idea of a partnership, you know, is what you think about, a couple of people in an office, maybe a small law firm. It wasn't a lot of income that was earned that way. Most of the serious business income was owned by corporations, you know, what you think of as a large corporation. What's remarkable is today, that so-called pass-through, those partnerships and other types like that, where they don't pay any tax at the business, they only pass it on to their owners, that's equal to all of the income in the large corporations. And it's astonishingly big. And the IRS, you know, for a lot of reasons, has not kept up with that. There is very little third-party reporting on that type of income and essentially almost no auditing. So that's $2 trillion a year that's pretty much untouched by compliance.
Almost no auditing. Okay, so Fred Goldberg, let's explore a little bit more about what auditing there is right now, because sticking with this the exploration of partnerships, I was reading that about 4 million partnership returns that were filed in 2018. This is according to those Treasury secretaries I mentioned earlier. The IRS audited only 140 of them. That's out of 4 million. Is that right?
That's what the data says. But Magna, a couple of quick comments. One is, in addition to the factors that Charles was going through, there's another factor, and that is technology. 21st century technology, whether you're talking cryptocurrency or the ability to move things around the world, technology has compounded that growth. And the sooner you get to our solution, the happier we're going to be, because that's really the money question here. But in terms of auditing, thanks to erosion in funding, audit rates have fallen dramatically. They are way below what they were, whether you're talking corporations or partnerships. I mean, 104, I mean, the number's staggering. So there is it's just not happening. And when it's not happening, it doesn't have the deterrence effect on other folks. That April 15th story you started this broadcast with, people paid attention. And at least some folks said, I'm getting out of that bad guy game.
I promise you I will get to your solutions, but I think I do. I promise you. This is an area that until recently, when experts like you started talking more vociferously about how bad the problem had become, I just don't think a lot of people thought of it. I mean, there's been a lot of national conversation about how unfair the tax code does seem to many people. But here we are talking about things that are already legally owed and just simply are not paid by very wealthy individuals. Like, for example, the IRS did not pursue 300 high-income taxpayers. And those 300 high-income taxpayers owed the country and I'm going to say the country here, not the IRS, they owed the country $10 billion in unpaid taxes over several years because they never even filed returns. Now, but I'm also seeing, though, that of the audits that are being done, there is a disparity in who's getting audited. Charles Rosati, can you help me understand that? That, like, in fact, if you're lower income now, you're more likely to be audited than if you're one of these high income earners who's not even filing their taxes?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a complicated subject.
Okay.
There is, a lot of small, what called small audits on, you know, refundable credits and things like that, which don't take a lot of time, whereas the upper end audits take huge amounts of time, even when they are being done. So that's really a considerable degree of reflection of the tremendous drop in resources. The, you know, the auditing at the upper is very complex. And also, as Fred said, it's not just people, it's a lack of technology. I mean, if you just turn a couple agents loose and tell them to do everything themselves and audit the data without any technology help, whereas the people on the other side have all the help they need from everything, not just technology, but well-paid advisors, you know, that's really not an even playing field. So I think that resource issue and technology issue is really what drives the problem you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of different ways of describing it, but it boils down to the same thing. There's just a ton of money out there, and it is mostly upper income taxpayers, that is just not getting reported.
Okay. And so this brings us back to the example that you brought up earlier, people who earn regular wages, and for example, their W-2s, those are the sort of misreporting rate is diminishingly low there because it's being reported to the IRS through a third party. But I'm also seeing here that, again, I love numbers, guys. I just can't help it. But
so do we.
Exactly. So for people who don't have that third party reporting, right? Again, the pass-throughs, et cetera, that we talked about, the misreporting rate could be 50%. So huge opportunity here. Now, as I promised, let's get to your solution here. So Fred Goldberg, you and Charles Rosati have come up with essentially a three-prong plan, as far as I can understand. So just give me the headlines of what the three prongs are, and then we'll explore each one of them in greater detail.
Sure. I'm going to defer to Charles.
Okay.
Because to be fair, he and a couple of other folks, former Secretary of Treasury, Natasha, have been chasing this for 2 years. The rest of us who've been IRS commissioners just have been frustrated since we had the job. So with due respect to Charles, because he was the guy who's been pushing this rock for a long time, Charles, why don't you summarize the big three?
Okay, let me summarize it. But we've been both deep into this. I mean, so look, it's basically simple to explain, but, you know, takes resources to implement. Number one, if the income that is underreported is not reported, you know, by third parties, go ahead and find a way to report it. Move it from low visibility to higher visibility. Make them on the same playing field as most people, like wage earners. And that's the first piece, a little bit more information reporting. Secondly, give the IRS the technology to look at that information, because astonishingly, Magna, this may astonish you even more, is that there are millions and millions of pieces of information the IRS has that they can't even use because they don't have the technology. All of that partnership income you're talking about, $2 trillion, they don't have any technology to analyze even the information they do have. So technology is key at the IRS level. And finally, they do have to have skilled people, because if you call up the IRS and you're legitimately trying to pay your tax, or there's an issue and you may want to resolve it and you can't get through, what good does that do? So you do need to have some staff. And that's the three prongs. Make the income more visible with some more information. Give the IRS the technology to analyze the information and give them some skilled staff to resolve the cases once they open one.
Okay. So go ahead.
The other piece of this is mandatory long-term funding. Mm. No business person in their right mind would try to run a business where they know their budget this year, but they have no darn idea what their funding is going to be next year. Commissioners, oh, hire 1,000 people this year. Next year, oh, by the way, sorry, don't hire any more people. And it's these components that make this work. To the extent these proposals are described as more money for more audits, that misses the most important point, which is this is a long-term investment. That's what the administration proposed. And it's in technology and it's in folks and people to do the work.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about specifically what the Biden administration has proposed regarding this a little later. But I take your point, because I also want to talk about, just foreshadowing here, about how the IRS's budget has been treated over the past 10 years and how that's contributed to the problem. But as I do want to get more deeply into these solutions. So, Fred Goldberg, sure. Can we just talk about the technology piece here? When Charles Rosati says that right now the IRS is lacking some of the technology necessary to even understand or analyze the information it currently is getting, what exactly does that mean?
What the basic, the essence of this is being able to link together information to paint a picture, just like the first person you had on the show today. Tell a story. Is it the guy hiding in Florida not reporting anything? The IRS needs the technology that lets them link that information together to paint exactly the kind of picture we heard at the outset. The technology is there to do it. It can do it. And it's important to note the IRS has already started doing it. The General Accounting Office that reviews IRS performance gave them good ratings on some of the things they are starting to do. So the IRS is not starting from zero. Mm-hmm. The IRS is moving down that road, but they've got a long, long journey ahead of them. And that's why the 10-year funding is important. Because look at when you get up in the morning and you look at your iPhone or iPad or computer, private sector technology is 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
IRS technology and its enforcement use of technology is they're still stuck somewhere in the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, I was seeing that modern day financial institutions, for example, are able to invest an order of magnitude greater in their technology than the IRS, which represents all of us, has been able to do. So there's a massive tech gap there. I suppose the reason why I asked, like, what exactly does this mean is because, look, my finances are never going to be as complex as the people we're talking about. I just, like, do my annual TurboTax return and hit send. And I'm like, I don't understand why the IRS can't figure things out. So you're the lack of sort of evasive sophistication on my part is what we're encountering here. But now, Charles Rosati, let's turn back to the visibility part that you talked about, that first prong in terms of getting more or creating third-party information that would reduce that misreporting of, pass-through, S-corp financials, things like that. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure.
What does that mean? Yeah.
So let me just set the background, okay? Think of it this way. It's like there's a big, huge bucket of water, which is all the information that describes, that's given to the IRS about what people's income is, all the 1099, your W-2. It's great. That's 3 billion, over three, almost 3.5 billion documents that come into the IRS every year and go to the taxpayer. Trouble is there's like a hole in the bottom of that bucket and a lot of water leaks out of that hole. That's the low visibility income. That's a lot of business income, both, you know, some individuals, but also all these pass-throughs. There isn't very, very little of information on that. So the first prong is fill the hole. And that's one additional 1099. There's now 22 1099s, about 3 billion documents. The administration and our suggestion to them is one additional 1099 that would be at a very summary level, providing the IRS and the taxpayer information on total money in and total money out of certain financial accounts. That would allow them to essentially fill the hole in that reporting on the type of income that uh-huh. isn't covered elsewhere.
So you're saying that the 1099 would basically force banks to tell the IRS more about what's actually flowing in and out of accounts.
Yeah, but not – I want to clear up one thing because there's been some confusion about this. It's not reporting every transaction, you know, everything that you spend. It's just like every you get on a 1099. If you have a bank account and you have more than $10 of interest, $10 – you'll get a document, the IRS will get a document said you had $25 of interest. That's one number for 1 year. We're adding two numbers to that, money in and money out once a year. It's not detailed information. It's none of that. But having that backstop fills that hole in the leaky bucket.
Well, so even just on this, though, there is some pushback, even though you're getting a lot of bipartisan interest for the plan. But Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho, Republican of Idaho, said he doesn't have a problem with helping the IRS get a stronger ability to focus and deal with wealthy individuals, partnerships, et cetera. But he also said, quote, "I don't think that Americans would support giving up their access to their own private financial information to the IRS or any government agency."
Yeah, and I wouldn't either. And that's not what the proposal is. It's not giving access. I mean, if your grandson or your son had a small bank account and got a 1099 reporting $50 of interest, was that giving up his access to his bank account? If you got a report that said you had, you know, a certain amount of money that was deposited in your account over the course of a year, is that giving up access? No, it really isn't. It's really a very modest addition to what most people already have, you know, in the form of reporting and putting people on the same level playing field.
I gotta take a quick break here. Charles Rosati and Fred Goldberg. We'll hear more about the other prongs of the solution when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking with Charles Rosati. He's a former commissioner of the IRS. He served under Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. Fred Goldberg is also with us. He, as well, is a former IRS commissioner who served under President George H.W. Bush. And they are walking us through a plan that was originally put forth by Charles Rosati and is gaining some traction finally in Washington about how to strengthen the IRS and recover money owed to the American people, trillions of dollars potentially, that's simply not being paid because of criminal tax evasion in the United States. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about the need for investment in technology. We talked about your idea of increasing the visibility of the kinds of income that these, particularly these high earners, have. And Fred Goldberg, I want to talk about the people part here. So first of all, how many people has the IRS lost in the past decade?
They've lost about 20% of their employees across the board. And there's a lot of focus on revenue agents and folks doing enforcement. But the other portion of the loss is personnel who help work with, answer questions, resolve issues with real taxpayers, the women and men who are the backbone of this country, the women and men who pay what they owe, those who – it takes more than 6 months to resolve a simple correspondence audit. So the reductions in staffing, dramatic reductions in audit coverage, but it goes beyond that. It goes to how the IRS serves taxpayers. Taxpayers have the right to expect timely answers, timely responses, timely resolution of issues. The other bucket is technology. The IRS could use literally thousands of more well-trained, skilled professionals that know 21st century use of technology, whether it's for service or for its compliance. So it's a whole across the board.
Well, but a 20% reduction in a workforce in any organization indicates that there hasn't been that the budget hasn't kept up, or the budget's been dramatically reduced. Isn't that what's happened to the IRS at least over the past decade?
Yes, ma'am. It hasn't kept up. You look at the increase the number of returns and the complexity of those returns and the complexity of the law is escalating rapidly. The number of personnel is shrinking. Doesn't work.
Mm. Well, Charles Rosati, I mean, I'm seeing here that functionally the IRS's current budget is no different than it was, what, back in 2010, right?
Yeah, I mean, and you have to recognize that a lot of the budget is for people. And as you know, if inflation goes up, if you keep the budget even the same, you're basically reducing the staff. So, I mean, I went even back over a longer period of time, 25 years, just simple numbers over, this is longer than Fred was, 25 years, staff's down 28%. Number of business returns, which is the important thing, is up 80%. So that doesn't compute.
So, but I want to stick with this budget part quite a bit longer, because this is where politics comes in, right? I mean, the IRS's budget isn't random. It's not subject to yeah, you know, to revenues yeah, based on customer service. It is appropriated by Congress. And so there, yeah, there has been almost a bipartisan, if you're looking over 25 years, a bipartisan effort to not increase the IRS's budget commensurate yeah, with the need for the services it has to provide.
And honestly, that has exactly what happened. Every once in a while, as Fred said, they'll say, oh, somebody will wake up and say, oh, my, we're not getting the money that we need from the tax gap. Let's say hire 1,000 people. The next year, they forget about it and say, no, let's cut it back. I mean, you just can't operate a business that way. And for 1 year, you can get by because things don't change that much in a year. But over 10 years, over 25 years, you end up what we have now, which is really unfair and completely unsustainable.
I mean, but is it politics that's driven that?
Yeah, I mean, it's politics more broadly, because it's, you know, the IRS, you know, let's put money into courthouses or let's put money into whatever you would like. On any 1 year, it looks, you know, maybe more attractive than a little bit more money for the IRS. How much harm would it do? This is why the only real solution, this is what Fred Goldberg said, you really have to have long-term commitment to the funding, because otherwise it'll come again, come and go, and you just be in the same boat that you're in now. And this is, I think, really the most important single thing about the administration's proposal, is that they're proposing a way to provide a more assured, more consistent long-term funding. Mm. That allows investment in technology, that allows investment in staff.
Now, in terms of, I think it's a what, they're proposing a mandatory 6% annual increase?
That's right. And that's about the level that the IRS, you know, you can't, if you gave the IRS all the money in the world tomorrow, it'd be terrible. Okay, you can't operate that way. So the 6% a year over and above what you have with inflation, that is about what they're proposing. And that is what we think makes sense.
Mm. Well, I don't know if the two of you want to go there, but I'm going to say it, and that is when I hear that, again, it's a deliberate choice by Congress over a quarter century to not keep up the budget of the part of the federal government whose job it is to collect revenue for the Treasury. And as we've spent quite a long time talking about, the people who are most likely to be the criminal tax evaders are the highest earners in the country. There's a strong overlap between the highest earners and the people funding the political races of the very men and women in Congress who are deciding the IRS's annual budget. So it seems like there was sort of a negative feedback loop there that you and others are trying to push back against. Now, you have testified before Congress. I know Charles has. Fred, I'm not sure if you have recently, but are you getting are ears more open than they have been before?
Well, I'm the one that
yes,
testified, and I think the answer is yes. And, you know, you heard Senator Crapo, you know, say he supported the whole idea. I think it was one of the committees. I mean, but there is reluctance because of, you know, legitimate concerns, not just about spending, but about, you know, could you use this information? Would it be too invasive? Those are all very legitimate questions that have to be answered. But in our view, I think they can be answered.
Yeah. Magna, part of just, I think one of the joys of your program is it permits candor, encourages candor. Some of the issues with the IRS, to be fair, are self-inflicted. Mm. They've made their share of mistakes. You have bipartisan champions of the IRS. Senator Grassley, who's head of the Finance Committee, guy has been a supporter of the IRS for a very long time. Folks like Rob Portman, And so there is bipartisan support. And like any organization, the IRS makes its share of mistakes, and some of the issues they've run into, they carry some of the responsibility. But the key takeaway, at least to me, is we are at a unique point where there is a will to transform what the IRS does and how it does it, in part to get compliance from the top 25%. If you can make a $1.4 trillion bite in that over 10 years and much more out the road, that's terrific. But workers are it's unfair twice over. It's unfair to workers because they pay what they owe. And it's unfair to workers until the IRS can deliver 21st century responsiveness to them. And we are at that juncture where this can happen. It's a question of whether they're gonna.
And Megan, can I just add into to Fred's point about, you know, say, if you're going to do this, you know, I think Candor is right. The Congress has to have real oversight of this. It's not like you're going to hand over a bunch of money to the IRS and come back in 10 years and say, gee, I hope you did something with that. You know, nobody's going to support that. We don't support that. We think there's very practical ways that the Congress can efficiently and productively conduct oversight of whether the IRS is actually meeting its goals on both service and compliance. And that's important, too. That sometimes hasn't been done as productively as it should be on any side. But we think there's, in the 21st century, partly using technology, that can be done more effectively as well.
Well, so let's get a few more specifics about what the Biden administration is proposing, an $80 billion budget boost for the IRS. Now, sorry, did you want to say something, Fred?
Yeah, you know, that is a headline number. It's a very peculiar number that most people, it's think of it more as a 6% a year increase over inflation. Because if you add up all the numbers that the IRS budget spends for 10 years, you get to a huge number. But most people don't think of budgets that way. If I think of my budget, you know, I think, okay, next year I'm going to spend 6% more, you know, for what I'm doing. And that's really a better way, I think, to think about it. Yes, over 10 years, naturally, anything in the federal budget adds up to a big headline number, but I don't think that's a good way to explain it.
Okay. And the Biden administration says that that annual increase per year point could allow the IRS to collect, according to the Biden administration, some $700 billion over the next 10 years. Does that sound like an optimistic or realistic number, Fred?
Okay, so there are three different independent estimates.
Yeah.
No, the answer is no, because it's only 10% of the tax cap over that period of time. So there are three different estimates. Their number is $700 billion over 10 years and 1.2. I think it's $4 trillion over 14 years. We have made an independent estimate, thinks you can do it faster by investing in technology, but you end up at the same place. And then there's a third party, the Penn Wharton Business School, that estimated they could get, you know, $480 billion in the first 10, but $1.3 trillion over 15 years. So it takes a different amounts of time on the three different estimates, depending on how you do it, how much technology you invest in. But they all come up to something over $1 trillion over some period of time, which is still only less than 20% of the tax gap.
Yeah. So
it's
a
monumental number.
I was literally just about to say that even the most optimistic estimate still leaves 80% of taxes owed out there somewhere and not in the federal treasury.
That's our estimate is we have the most optimistic, if you want to call it that, because we're putting more emphasis on technology maybe than the others are. But even that's only 19% over 10 years, is 81% left.
Huh. Well, so can I come back to a second about areas in which this idea, even though it might be gaining traction right now in Washington, where you might be getting pushback? And I keep thinking about in the third-party reporting that you both talked about. I mean, I imagine that, are you hearing from financial institutions themselves? Are they pushing back on having to do that reporting?
The associations have issued a letter. The various financial associations have issued a letter, you know, raising concerns. And, you know, in fairness, nobody likes to be given a compliance requirement. But there's a lot of misinformation about that, too, or let's say misunderstanding, because the proposal that is being advanced by us and by the Biden administration is not a complex one. It's nothing more than a 1099 that they already do, adding some numbers to it. So, you know, and it's fully automated, be once a year. So nobody likes to add a compliance requirement. I understand that. I've been on the board of several banks. But if you really get down to it, this is a very, very modest requirement on the financial providers.
Fred Goldberg, I don't know how else to say this other than this seems so sensible, right? I mean, maybe it's just the elegant simplicity with which the two of you are laying out this plan. I'm having a hard time understanding why it hadn't been implemented before. Am I misreading this, or is this one of those rare moments in which there is a clear, comprehensible problem that has a solution that perhaps won't be undermined by Washington politics? If you hear the disbelief in my voice, I think it's because I'm so habituated now to presuming that Washington just can't work.
I think this is a time of change, and I think it's going to happen. Is it going to be exactly what we've proposed? No. Is it going to be exactly what the administration proposed? No. But it's going to be expanded information reporting. Congress already did that once this year. It's going to be a focus on technology, and it's going to be the kind of stability that lets a rational operation function rationally. And we underestimate the quality of the career IRS staff. It is a terrific, dedicated groups of folks. And so I'm completely optimistic it's going to happen, and it's going to make a difference.
Charles Rosati, I'm going to reserve the right to maintain some of my cynicism about how Congress works.
But you have every right to do that.
Well, because we
sometimes are accused of being ridiculous optimists.
Well, because I'm just thinking, what it was back in 2012-ish, around then, where there was a firestorm at the IRS or surrounding the IRS because Republicans in Congress had accused the IRS of allegedly targeting conservative groups when reviewing tax-exempt applications. So any proposal that might increase the number of audits on individuals, I imagine, ultimately might fall into the same sort of political trap, don't you think?
Well, there are political traps everywhere. And I think that's why I said that I think it is important that there be a very clear regimen of oversight by the Congress if this is done. I mean, I totally agree with that. I mean, the IRS is great, but it needs guidance, it needs oversight. Every organization does. And I think that, you know, what we think is possible here, if it's done correctly, is that can be done in a very constructive way by the Congress. And we've laid out some ways that can be done.
Okay.
I am optimistic because we are the Joes with the dough. And everybody wants to break bread at our table because we got the money. This approach gets them the money to pay for things. There is bipartisan agreement on what should be done. So come on down. We're serving dinner. Pass this and buy what you think you ought to buy.
Well, I have
that's how it works.
I have to say the listeners are really responding to what they're hearing now. Tons of comments. Maggie says, if you can't collect taxes already owed, raising the rate won't make a difference. You still cannot collect the now higher amount. Oh, Jessica Thomas says the ones who need their taxes raised are also the ones exploiting loopholes and offshoring money so they don't have to pay, a luxury the rest of us don't have. And PGP says raising taxes on the rich means we would have to have the money to go after folks who don't pay. That said, if taxes don't get raised on the rich, then obviously we need to figure out a way to crack down on unpaid taxes. So very rare that we have an almost uniform point of view when folks like a plan, but this may be a first for us. So Charles Rosati, former IRS commissioner under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Magna.
And Fred Goldberg, former IRS commissioner under President George H.W. Bush, thank you so very much as well.
Thank you, Magna.
And we've got links to their plan at onpointradio.org. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.